from HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 310, recorded live Thursday, March 15th, 2012. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode of the Startup Series, Scott talks with Rob Walling about purchasing small companies or online applications and revitalizing them.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. And I'm doing the Startup Series as I discover interesting new startups. It's not necessarily a regular thing, but here's two in a row. We're talking to Rob Walling, who has an interesting startup story because he has acquired some code that maybe I wouldn't have acquired. I don't know. Rob, how's it going?
It's going well. Thanks for having me.
So you acquired a product that was already out there. You've acquired some data. Tell me about what you got.
Yeah, so the product is called HitTail, and it was built in 2005. I think it either went live in late 2005 or 2006. And shockingly enough, it was written in classic ASP. I don't know why they didn't do .NET, you know, because it was, I mean, we were at .NET 2.0 by then? 2.5? Anyways, yeah, so they wrote it in classic ASP, and I've been a customer of it for several years. It's essentially, it's an application that gives you suggestions for keywords that you should target if you do search engine optimization. And so I've been a customer for several years, and it started having a lot of downtime due to hardware problems. The code has been quite solid, but they were having servers that were failing and such. So in 2011, they had like a 5-day outage at one point. And so I basically got in touch with the former owner and acquired the product. And we closed late August of 2011.
And did you know it was written in classic ASP?
I didn't. Not until I got in touch with her. I should have looked. I mean, everything has the ASP extension. I had just never paid attention. You know, when you use a software as a service app, I don't tend to look at the extension of things. And I had no idea if it was PHP or ASP.NET or anything.
Just never thought about it, never consciously came to the forefront.
Yeah, most apps that I use, I don't know about most people, but I don't, even as a developer, I mean, I've been writing .NET since 2002 and mm-hmm. classic ASP before then. Sometimes I'll look if I'm curious. If something's particularly slick, I'll say, oh, is this a Microsoft thing? You know, is it written in stuff I work in? Because I can be really proud of it. But not for most apps, I think I just go about doing them without asking what they're written in.
I wrote a blog post last week about what I call dark matter developers, and talking about the developers that we don't see on the blogs and they don't go to conferences and stuff. And a lot of people understood where I was coming from, but a reasonably large group of people felt they were kind of offended because I was implying that people who were on the blogs and presumably people like myself, so I think there was some ego that was associated with that post, implied that we're moving the web forward while you guys kind of sit in the background and work on classic ASP and COBOL and stuff like that. So then a large amount of people kind of came out of the darkness and said, you know, we're getting work done. We're doing really useful stuff. I'm working on, you know, code that might be 20 or 30 years old, but, you know, you can't beat an RPG program on an AS400 when it comes to like raw productivity, even now. So I thought it was interesting that a number of people were like, just because you can't see us doesn't mean we're not getting a lot of work done. And I realized that post may have come off that way. So I don't want to sound like classic ASP, I'm looking down on it, because not everyone, I mean, there's perfectly good work being done right now in .NET 1 and 2. But at the same time, I do remember doing classic ASP more than 10 years ago, I think even 15 years ago. When you saw that, you're in the process, you're having the conversation, did it give you pause at all? Did you look down your nose at this classic ASP and maybe not think about not acquiring it?
It did give me pause. And the biggest reason is not even a looking down my nose at it. It was more of a, can I go back to that development environment? Can I go back to not being able to step through debug and do response.writes and having weekly type variables and just all the stuff that comes along with that? And I just remember the transition from classic ASP to .NET as I made it back in 2001, 2002, and how good that felt. And I didn't even really remember classic ASP. I haven't touched it since then. I mean, it's been 10 years. And so all I remembered, it was kind of dark memories in my head of being frustrated and not being able to debug as well as I wanted. And so it did give me some pause, but there's so much value in this product that I was going to acquire that I knew A, that I'd be able to get over that, you know, and I'd deal with it and, you know, write the code. And B, I am going to wind up, you know, hiring someone part-time to help me out with it. So I won't be, it's not like I'm going to be coding a classic ASP 40 hours a week for the next 5 years, right? I'm actually, you know, I have outs where I don't have to do that.
So when you purchase something or you acquire a product, you know, there's the perceived value of this product, and then there's this kind of imaginary pie chart that represents all of the intellectual property that makes up that product. Is this thing like half code and half data? Or, you know, what does that pie chart look like? Like, how much of this is legacy code and versus how much of this is just really interesting data that's in a database somewhere? Because I think if a lot of it was data, I would feel more comfortable about older code.
Right, in terms of the value of actually paying for this.
Well, and also feeling like I wouldn't be messed. Like let's say it was 90% data and 10% code, and it represented a couple of thousand lines of code. Since it's classic ASP, I would feel very comfortable rewriting it in PHP or rewriting it in ASP.NET web pages.
Right, I see. There is a tremendous, there's more than a billion rows in the database, SQL Server 2005 database, and it's about 300 gigs of data. And so that contains a lot of the kind of the intelligence, you know, and a lot of the legacy of the app and a lot of the value of actually acquiring it. There are, I would estimate, maybe, I don't think there are 10,000 lines, somewhere in the 5 to 10,000 lines of code range. And there's quite a bit of JavaScript. There's a lot of hand-coded JavaScript because there was no jQuery back then. And so there's Ajax in there that's been just hand-coded from scratch. And then there's, you know, a ton of ASP. I think that one of the things that made me realize that I should acquire the product is that this code has been running. And for the last 3 years, it's been running essentially without technical maintenance at all because the original developers left in 2008. They moved on to other projects. And so the former owner's non-technical. And so there was no database re-indexing. There were no code changes. It was pretty much just running, and it was running solid. The app actually does a lot of real-time. It takes a lot of real-time data from websites, right? It's almost like Google Analytics where you install a little snippet of JavaScript on your website as a customer, and then every time you get a hit from a search engine, it pings back to the main server and it stores it in the Hittail database. So it's not a trivial app. There's actually a lot of volume. There can be 20, 30 database inserts per second at peak times. And this thing ran without modification and without maintenance for 3 years. So that was actually, even though it's old code, that was a reason for me to think about how solid this old code was, because it has run for so many years and it has been debugged. So I think there's a lot of value in that.
So how does the code and the way the code was written relate to the fact that the database is so big and the database is apparently well designed and perhaps organized enough that it's doing it, you know, appropriate indexing and it didn't require database checks and things like that? This sounds like you're saying SQL Server. I mean, I'm brainstorming here. I'm pushing a little bit, but it sounds like you're saying SQL Server 2005 is really good. How does that make the code really good?
Yeah, I guess all I'm saying is the code is efficient and the code, it doesn't have any major bugs. Like, they worked all of that out in the early days. And for the fact that the code to continue to run like that, you're right. It probably is more of a SQL Server thing, but just that it has a lot of kinks worked out. And so I could have rewritten. I mean, rewriting Hittail, I was either going to do it myself or, you know, get some help and do it if I wasn't able to acquire it, because I really liked the idea. Mm-hmm. It would take, you know, 4 to 6 months to do it full time. But I knew that you'd have to go through all the headaches and all the trials and tribulations that they went through in the early days to make this a good product and not have to go through those again.
The database, they said that it went down for 5 days. So it went great for 3 years and everything was great. And you said this is a really valuable piece of intellectual property here. And then it went down for 5 days. When did that 5 days happen, and how does that not erode your confidence in the previous 3 years?
Right. Yeah, what was actually happening, it was going down probably every couple of months, every 2 to 3 months, and it was hardware failures. So disk drives would fail, power supplies would fail, that kind of stuff. It was never, to my knowledge, and I talked to the previous developers, it was never the code or the database that was failing. So that was actually the first goal when I acquired Hittail, was to get it off the old hardware, because it was on generic, you know, not Dell, not HP, just generic white box servers. And they had, I think they'd been purchased used on eBay in 2006. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a really low budget operation. And so obviously these hard drives failing is just, you know, naturally going to happen. So yeah, the 5-day failure came in, I think, May of 2011. And then nice. I wound up contacting them in June and getting it in August.
And were they like excited about you calling them? Had they forgotten about the product, or was this a product that was sitting in the background doing a lot of work and making money for them?
It was, it was down to a single owner, and she was happy to discuss the acquisition because she knew that the product had, it has so much intelligence in it, and it has a lot of potential, and it had done a lot of good things for a lot of people as they've used it over the years. And she saw it failing, and that pained her to do it, but she didn't have the time or the resources to kind of rehab it, basically. I mean, it's kind of like that old broken down house that has so much potential, needs a new coat of paint and maybe some new electrical. And they really did love the product, and they're still fans of it, you know? And so the fact that someone was willing to come along and talk about revitalizing it, and they know most of the customers. I mean, there were, you know, 100 or 200 customers when I acquired it, and they know a lot of them by first name. So they were all excited that it would actually have a second life, essentially.
What have you done to it since? I assume you've done something with the hardware. I mean, when someone purchases a fixer-upper and they're excited about it, it does breathe new energy into the house, into the product. What have you done in that way?
Yeah, over the past, it's been about six and a half months since I acquired it, and I had really three goals. The first priority was to get it stable, meaning get it on the new hardware. And then second was to basically redesign the app, not from a back-end stance, but the front end was very dated, and so I just wanted a new marketing site that would help with, basically help people have more confidence in the application, because it looked like something from, you know, a 10-year-old app. And then the third thing was to get the marketing started. And so that first priority of stabilizing it involved moving it from the old hardware to a new colo facility. I'm actually hosting with Orcs Web, ORCS Web, out in Virginia, and I'm on one of their cloud servers. And it was quite a big deal to move it, because it's not a trivial task to move a 300 gig database. You can't just send that across the internet, especially when it's real time. There's between 5 and 30 database inserts happening every second. And so I had to actually hire a DBA to help me out, because I just didn't even really know how to attack that problem. And so he helped setting up replication between two instances. And it was sending, you know, data over the wire to Virginia, and then we had a USP. We went with the old postal service and got a three 500 gig USB drive and put the database on it, and then shipped it overnight and got the big bulk of the data over to the data center that way. And then we pulled an all-nighter to kind of get it all synced up.
Isn't that funny how UPS, they always talk about that, how UPS has more bandwidth than even the fastest internet connection. If you can overnight, you know, half a terabyte, then that's pretty darn good bandwidth if you look at it like per second, megabytes per second.
It absolutely is. Yep.
So you refreshed all the hardware, you refreshed the marketing site. Is there an API that people call to talk to this? And is it an old style one? Are there new techniques around JSON or jQuery that someone might use in order to access this data?
Well, so the data, at this point, there is no API. I have one in the works. I've been building it, a REST API using the .NET components. I don't even remember. It's funny. It's WCF. Sorry. WCF has all the, you know, the stuff in it to do a really nice REST API. And so we're about halfway through that. To get to the data, I mean, it's really a reporting app. It's more like, think of it like Google Analytics, where you install the code on your site, it puts it into a database, and then you log into our web portal, and you can see all the keywords that people have hit your site with, and then we actually have an algorithm that gives you suggestions of terms that you are not targeting that you should be targeting if you want more traffic. And you can export everything as CSV. I mean, that's really you said UPS has the ultimate bandwidth. It's like CSV is the ultimate API, because then you can do whatever you want with it.
When you start approaching someone about a product like this, how do you even know in your mind where the right number is? How do you know you didn't overpay or underpay?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There are ranges, kind of best practice ranges. I've acquired a number of products over the past 7 or 8 years. And in essence, depending on how long of an earnings history the product has, how much money it's making per month, and how much maintenance it requires, the range, it typically starts around 12 months of monthly net profit. So like one year's worth. But if the product is in bad shape, or it needs a lot of work, or it needs a lot of monthly maintenance, then it might be 4 to 6 months of monthly net profit. And if it's a really good product that's been mentioned in a lot of print magazines, or like this one had been mentioned in TechCrunch and Wall Street Journal, and I mean, it was a big app back in the day when it launched, then it has more clout. It just has more inbound links. It has more SEO traffic. It has more to it than being some trivial app. It can sell for upwards of 24, maybe even up to 30 months of net profit. So it's kind of your range that you go into it with, mm-hmm. which is very different from, dot-com valuations. A lot of people, if you approach them about their product, they feel like, well, Facebook sells for, or it's valued at X dollars per free user that they have. And that's not really how it works with these smaller apps. It is much more based on kind of the earnings, an earnings multiple.
But what is the difference? You're saying that someone might have a product with 10,000 users, and they might be thinking it's like Facebook and think that it's a per-user valuation. Well, mm-hmm. the real thing that they should be using is they've made $1,000 a month for the last 12 months, and this is how much it's worth. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'll say that it's kind of like what's generally accepted versus what is, it's like what does everyone use versus what someone thinks their app is worth, mm-hmm. particularly. So that's kind of confusing. There's kind of this whole group of people that are buying and selling these apps and websites. There's a group on Flippa, Flippa.com. There's a group on SitePoint, and multiples are how these things are typically valued. But it doesn't mean everyone has to adhere to that, right? If someone does have 10,000 users and they say, well, my app, I'm not going to sell it for less than 50 or 100 grand, then that's up to them. It's just they have to find a buyer who's willing to do that. And if they mm-hmm. go with folks who typically buy apps, they're probably not going to find someone to do that. It really is a difference between buying smaller profit-generating apps and going with the dot-com valuations. If you start an app that is going to be a social network and it is going to be wildly successful and you have 10,000 people already, then maybe you could convince someone that it's going to have massive growth. But an app like Hittail or other apps I bought, they just aren't going to scale up that quickly. And so I would never value them based on free users or anything. I mean, there's kind of a formula that you can rely on for that.
So at that point, that means that you're kind of at the mercy of the person who owns it. If they are delusional or confused or simply uneducated about the way things that work, you might just not be, you might reach an impasse very quickly in the discussion.
Yep. And it's better to reach that early, to be honest, before you spend a lot of time on it or before you make them spend a lot of time, pulling a lot of data out. Because frankly, before you make an offer, you want to get maybe 10 to 12 data points from them. You want to know how much it's making, the expenses, how much time they spend per month, how much it costs them to acquire a customer. I mean, there's kind of some basic things you need to figure out in order to figure out what this thing is worth, what you're going to offer for it. And so before you make them go do all that legwork, I often will start chatting them up about, here's how, have you heard about this? Here's how sites are typically valued. If this isn't going to work, then that's fine, but let's not, waste your time or mine, frankly.
It seems like such a delicate thing, though.
It is a delicate thing.
I mean, you don't want to. You're the buyer. You want to give them money, and they want to get as much money as they can, and you want to pay as little as you can, and you're the one educating them on what they need to do. to yeah. make their price. Unless, because if you're buying products all the time and this is the first one they've ever sold, they're going to be inherently distrustful of you.
Yep, that's true. That's true. And so that, frankly, my first several emails, if I'm going to be acquiring something like this, tends to be to build trust. And that's the goal, is to say, look, I've done this before. Here's my blog. Here I am on LinkedIn. Like, I'm a real person. I've written a book. I own these other apps. Like, I really try to be transparent, to say I'm accountable because I'm a real person. I'm not just some email address that's kind of emailing you out of the blue. And that, you're right, it is a balancing act of trying to build trust quickly, and show that I'm a legitimate buyer, and I'm not going to try to screw them around. In addition, I'm also trying to gain trust in them as a seller, because some sellers may be a little, they may exaggerate their numbers, you know, and you need to get proof of their numbers. You need to get screenshots or screencasts of their actual traffic and their revenue and such. And so I'm trying to gauge the seller, and typically really enjoy having a video Skype session with them, because when you can look someone in the eye, it just it means a lot in terms of knowing, you know.
So email is not the place where you do this kind of work. Like, you may email, you may set up some meetings and things like that, but really you do need to see someone before you give them a lot of money.
A lot of money, yeah. Yeah, email is where we start setting it up, and then typically the getting to know you and the trust building is on just a single Skype session where we'll just chat about stuff. We don't negotiate over Skype, because it's just people need time to think, and it's much easier to do actual dollar negotiations and make the initial offer via email and then just go back and forth via email, I've found. It's better to do with things in writing as well, so there's a track record of it. And that means it takes a long time. You know, it took me six or 8 weeks from the time I made the first offer on this until we were able to close the deal, because there's just a lot of back and forth about not only price, but just other terms of who's going to pay the legal fees, because there's, you know, we're going to have to have a contract written up to close this. Who's going to go clear out the data center, the old data center, you know, where they have their servers, because someone has to go throw stuff in the dumpster. That kind of stuff. So a lot of different terms come up, and it's good to have those. Good to have an email trail of what we discussed about all that.
So it sounds like everything that could be talked about gets talked about. I never would have thought about who pays for the person who cleans up their old data center. I mean, surely that can't be you, but I wouldn't have even thought about it. But I think your point is that if you don't write it down, it'll become a point of contention later.
That's right. Yep. And I wouldn't have thought about it either, to be honest, but she brought it up. So
I just... Out of curiosity, who did end up paying for the dumpster at the data center?
She actually, the data center was in New York, and she lived in New York, so she volunteered to go by and do it. I volunteered to pay for legal expenses, and she went and did it herself, and FedExed me the disks. You know, there were a bunch of CD-ROMs with install disks, and then, yeah, she did chuck the servers, mashed. I made sure that she hit the hard drives with hammers and broke them up, because all the data, you know, you don't want that getting out, but... She chucked everything in the dumpster.
Wow. It sounds like this is like a lot like buying a house, and you really have to hope that the seller of the house is a good person, and that you're not going to discover skeletons in the closet.
That is true. No matter how much you put in a contract, it's never enough. If the person is trying to screw you, they'll probably figure out a way to do it. So you're right. You have to trust. I think you have to trust from both sides. Even today, you know, last week I figured out that there's a Twitter account attached to Hittail. And I just didn't know that. I'd forgotten to mention it. And so I emailed them, and she's just like happy to help. You know, it's like she genuinely wants it to succeed, and she's not going to try to, I mean, I could imagine some seller saying, well, you didn't negotiate for that. Well, I'm going to charge you for it. It has 500 followers, you know, or whatever. Some people could feasibly do that, but not with these guys. I mean, they're really open to giving up the assets that belong to it, even if they're not written in the contract. And that's a good thing to have.
Such a challenge to know. You know, you have to go with your, you have to do your math, you have to do your data, you have to do your due diligence, but then at the same time you are making a leap of faith. And you have to go with your gut.
That's right. There is definitely some gut involved. And I think it gets easier. Obviously my first one was a lot scarier. But even now, what I find is that every time after I close a deal, there's always some big surprise that I missed. And it's always something different, but there's always something that I wake up, you know, 3 weeks later and I discover, oh, either there wasn't as much as I thought, or one of the numbers was wrong. And it wasn't intentionally wrong, but their database you know, with Hittail as an example, their customer database was just was pretty fuzzy. And when I went in and queried some things, there wasn't quite as many customers as we had discussed. And she was generally looking at a report that showed her X, and it was less than X, and it was because their data was bad. So that just is going to happen, and every time that happens, I totally use that as motivation to grow the thing, you know, rather than to be devastated that I made a mistake or something like that.
So was that the surprise? That was the quote unquote bad thing in this instance?
That
it doesn't sound
surprise.
Like it soured you on the thing.
Yeah, it didn't sour me. No, it just made me, like I said, I always know that there's going to be some surprise, and I was waiting for the shoe to drop, frankly. And when I found it, I was like, oh, okay, I can get over this. This is not that bad. I remember thinking that. I've had worse. You know, I've had worse where I've acquired an app and emailed the former or the current customers and then just been barraged with replies that say, this app hasn't been supported. It has a bunch of bugs. The former owners were trying to screw us. They didn't supply. They didn't release new versions. And I just had no idea. And I should have done that in due diligence. That wasn't with Hittail. That was with a former acquisition. And so that one really panicked me because I started thinking, wow, I kind of acquired a piece of crap where I'm going to have to invest a bunch of time not only to fix the app, but then to smooth this over with customers and then move forward. Whereas with Hittail, at least the code was solid and the customers, aside from the downtime, which I knew I could fix, they were happy. So to find out that there wasn't quite as much revenue, quite as many customers as I thought wasn't the end of the world.
When you're doing a startup or revitalizing a startup or putting more energy into a product that has maybe plateaued a little bit, it seems like there's always a sense of urgency. There's always this rush, like, if we don't provide value in the next 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, then this thing will effectively be zero value. And there's always that kind of internet panic. You know, the internet's moving on without us. How do you know when a product provides lasting value that has been around and will be around versus maybe you just, you know, how don't you know that Hittail won't be worthless in 5 years?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question, actually. So most of the products that I own are in smaller niches, and they're kind of evergreen in the sense that I own invoicing software. It's like people are always going to need to invoice. You know, that's not in the category of something that's going to go out of style. Hittail is probably the most startup-ish thing that I've acquired, where you're right, it could feasibly, you know, what if Google suddenly changed and decided not to send any keywords? They've already made a change where if you're logged into Google and you do a search, your keywords are not sent to that website anymore. And so now I can't get those through Hittail. So it actually reduces the number of keywords we can track by about 10%. But yeah, what if suddenly tomorrow Google turned off the spigot the whole way and doesn't allow any keywords? Hittail would literally be out of business. There would be no value in Hittail. So there is a risk there, and I knew that up front. But at the same time, it's kind of a weighted risk, right? It's like, I don't think Google is going to do that. I know that this tool has run for 5.5 years, and it's not algorithm dependent. It doesn't depend on Google's algorithm. It has code and infrastructure that has run and that has worked and that has continued to provide value. I've been using it myself, and so I knew that. I didn't even have to go ask customers if this thing worked. I knew that it provided lasting value. So to look out 5 years, yeah, there is a chance that Hittail could just be put out of business by something. But it's not as risky as something like, I don't know, maybe a Pinterest or a Foursquare, where it really does, things go in and out of style, like you said, in 9 months. Hittail does have more of a business case. It actually provides real value. And as long as people are doing marketing online and needing topics to talk about, and keyword suggestions, then, you know, Hittail will have some value. So I do see it as a long-term app.
Now, this is a thing you do. Like, this has become your thing. Did you know that you would go and acquire a number of small to medium-sized products? I know you're building a portfolio like someone builds a portfolio of real estate. I mean, it sounds like it.
Yeah, I that is exactly what I've done, and I didn't really set out to do that from the start. But I've actually started getting contacted now by people who want to sell apps. And they'll say, oh, I have an app written in .NET. It does this. Are you interested? I've heard you buy them. So I guess I had good luck with the first few, and that has allowed me to, I mean, eventually allowed me to quit consulting, which freed up a whole bunch more time for me to work on code and to do things that I enjoy doing, which is, you know, working on these applications. And then from there, as new opportunities come by, I mean, sometimes it's actually a lot of times it's just a lot faster to buy it than it is to build it, you know? And since I have that, there's money coming off of the apps that I've already purchased, there's some money there to buy these new ones. And so while it may, may cost, you know, 10 grand, 20 grand to buy one of these apps, it saves me and a developer who I would hire 6 months of time, then it's kind of a no-brainer in terms of the payoff.
Is there a plan for how you want your portfolio to look?
I do have criteria. I really like to stay in pretty small niches. I like for things to be evergreen, like I said, meaning that they're going to be able to serve customers for years and it's not some flash in the pan thing. My wife's on Pinterest and I think Pinterest is going to be huge, but I will probably not buy anything dealing with Pinterest because I just don't know. It's almost that, you know how Warren Buffett doesn't invest in tech stocks? I like to think of myself like, I realize I'm surrounded by technology, but I'm trying not to be on those fast trains that can either skyrocket, kind of gold rush, or they go up and then crash pretty quick. And so I really do go after smaller, more business-oriented things that can be sold based on value, meaning that they either save someone money or they make them money. Because I don't know how to sell. I wouldn't even know what to do with a game, you know, as an example, or a social network. I wouldn't know how to market that. I wouldn't know how to get people to use it. I mean, it doesn't make sense. Whereas I can tell someone, you know, this will save you time on your invoicing, or this will make you money because more people will pay. That's a pretty standard thing in all of my products.
I liked your example early on when you said that people will always have to do invoicing. You know, that's a very kind of fundamental attitude. You know, there are things people will always want to do. Will people always want to pin things to their Tumblr? Who knows, right? I mean, Posturus got bought by Twitter a couple days ago, which effectively means Posturus is going to die. You know, it was a ridiculous thing, and everyone's going to lose, you know? And if it's one of those products where they make no money and they provide no actual business value, they simply have users and users are fickle, then I can totally understand why you'd want to stay in a small niche. I've heard from a number of people who make small products that the nichier that you are, the better. Like, I know a guy who makes point-of-sale software and back-end office software for eye doctors.
That's, you know, awesome.
Super niche, and it's like there's like six people in the space.
Yep. And that, there's so many benefits that come with that. You're marketing. You're not marketing against large companies like Microsoft who really, or Google or Facebook, who have big marketing budgets and who really know what they're doing. You're marketing against other really small companies. And in addition, if you do build a better product, it actually can circulate because word of mouth is really strong in small niches. And frankly, it's just, if you are successful, no one's ever going to swoop in from Google and try to attack that niche and take you out. Whereas, you know, I do have friends who launch in the larger niches and then, oh, Google implemented Calendar, you know, and it put Kiko out of business. I don't know if you remember them. Or a friend of mine was trying to do online, before Google Docs, he was doing online word processing. And then Google bought Writely. He was smoked. Like, you know, it really is a matter of staying out of the way of the giants if you don't want to compete with them. Competing with them is certainly not a bad strategy, but it's just not something that I enjoy doing. I do like staying closer to the code and being able to have, you know, real software that provides value for businesses and does it over the long term. And that means that I will probably always stay with niches. Frankly, Hittail is the least niche product that I have. I mean, it does, you know, it's targeted more towards search engine optimizers and people who run shopping cart websites, e-commerce websites, and bloggers. And so those are pretty broad niches, frankly. All my other ones are much tighter.
Well, thanks for taking the time to talk to us today, Rob. We really appreciate it. This gives us an insight into a space that I don't think everyone's familiar with.
Yeah, really appreciate you having me. Thanks.
Do you have a blog or anything we can point people to where they can learn more about what you do and some of your products?
Yeah, I blog at softwarebyrob.com.
All right, fantastic. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.